I'd like to tell you about somebody a little different from this dark figure, this maniacal killer that seems to come across in at least a couple of in the book I was reading just prior to coming down here. He was a bright, interesting guy with a good sense of humor. My mother liked him, my wife liked him, all my kids liked him. But he was not only left-handed literally, but figuratively too. He reminded me, when he was younger at least, of the young man in Catcher in the Rye. He was well-meaning, screw-up. He could find more ways to mess up his life than anybody I ever met.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the third episode of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm Ryan Krause, your host in all this madness. So today we're going to do a two-part episode that acts as a companion to each of our previous shows. In the first part of our time together, we'll do a quick exploration of the Santa Rosa Hitchhiker murders and their potential connection to the Zodiac. Now I should mention these killings are also referred to as the Sonoma Co-Ed murders, a reference to Sonoma State, or Sonoma County. You know, where Zodiac Prime suspect Arthur Lee Allen was a full-time student during his period? He even lived in a trailer in Santa Rosa. But the crimes didn't fit the Zodiac's MO, right? The bodies of nude, dead young girls thrown down embankments off the side of the road in the middle of the night? It couldn't have been him. Yet, if Allen was a known child molester with an appetite for little boys and girls, how could he have been the Zodiac, who became notorious for killing young heterosexual couples? So, we'll explore the psychology of his potentially shifting motives, and how they might have evolved to a place where a new identity manifested itself in silence. As the Zodiac himself wrote in 1971, after claiming his last confirmed victim, and shortly before the Santa Rosa murders began, quote, "I shall no longer announce to anyone." Then, in the second part of the show, we'll dive into some further analysis of the evidence in the JonBenet Ramsey case that we didn't get a chance to closely examine last time. Even a strange connection to our friend, the Zodiac. So, diving right into the Santa Rosa murders, the first thing that becomes apparent to me is a shocking lack of evidence in the case. Now, it could be the work of multiple killers, but there is still very little to suggest that anybody in the 1970s cared much about dead bodies that were dumped on the side of the road. I mean, if you were to diagram all the bodies attributed to roadside dumping of remains during that era, just in terms of serial killers, the result would surely be astounding. The lack of DNA as an evidentiary source at the time meant that all you had to do to get away with dumping a body was not leave fingerprints, semen, hair, or blood on it. If you could avoid being seen, leaving tire marks or footprints, you basically committed the perfect crime. These days, we have forensic capabilities that preclude even the most deceptive of practices, and hitchhiking has long since been debunked as a good idea. But let's go back and try to get inside the head of a killer, one in particular. So, the first girls to disappear were Yvonne Weber, 13, and Maureen Sterling, 12. One of the girls' mothers dropped them off at an ice skating rink earlier that evening around 7:30 p.m. on February 4, 1972. Apparently, she returned at 11 p.m., and the kids were already gone. Nobody heard from them ever again. Later reports had them hitchhiking north of Santa Rosa. Then, on December 28, 1972, their remains are discovered thrown down a steep roadside embankment, but not identified for about another month afterward. A cause of death was not able to be determined. By this time, however, other girls had become victims. The first was Kim Wendy Allen, a 19-year-old Santa Rosa college student who was raped, strangled slowly with a quarter rope, and later found by two teens out for a motorcycle ride who thought they'd seen a mannequin lying in a creek bed. From 1972 to 1979, the bodies of eight girls were found, seemingly all victims of similar crimes. All but one was ultimately identified, and all had been nude, except for Jeanette Camahill, a 20-year-old Santa Rosa College student whose body was actually never found. Among the other victims was Lori Lee Kersaw, 13, a middle school student who went missing on November 11, 1972. Known to have hitchhiked before, it seemed to make sense when her remains were discovered frozen in a ravine about a month later. The cause of death was a broken neck and compressed spinal cord. While the girl was not raped, it was apparent the body had been thrown at least 30 feet over an embankment. The first indication the killer was either a very strong man, or perhaps there were two of them. This consideration would come into play again on July 31, 1973, when the body of 14-year-old Carolyn Davis was found dumped only a few feet away from where the first girls to disappear, Yvonne Weber and Maureen Sterling, were discovered by police. In what seemed like an incredibly audacious move by the killer to dump there again, many have suggested this was the work of someone who wanted a body attributed to another killer to distance them from suspicion. This is quite plausible considering the cause of death was strychnine poisoning, a far, far cry from strangulation. Again, investigators could not determine if she had been raped. Now, the truly eerie aspect of this killing is the fact that the killer was able to throw the body down the embankment from the roadside without disturbing any of the branches on the bushes jutting out in all directions there. So, essentially, this person was strong enough to toss a limp human body high enough into the air to clear them. The only thing left in his wake was a mark in the dirt where it seemed a shoe had slipped toward the hillside. So, were police dealing with two men? If so, which two men? Weren't there a couple of guys about to become infamous later that decade for being the hillside stranglers? Was this actually the work of Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono, who later terrorized Los Angeles in much the same manner? According to police, no. And there were other victims. In fact, there are at least seven other women, aside from the eight mentioned previously, who might have fallen prey to this maniac. But who was he? He was obviously good at what he did, so one might think he had experience. But it would have to be someone who eventually left us a clue. Maybe even something intentional. Like when victim Kim Wendy Allen disappeared while carrying a soy barrel that was never recovered, only to have the Zodiac use a symbol that had been printed on it in his famous exorcist letter in 1974. But the Zodiac didn't strangle women. Right? San Francisco police once decided a Zodiac letter was faked because one of the methods of killing listed within was, quote, by rope. Maybe it was Ted Bundy. These crimes really seem to fit his... Nope. The handsome charmer slash sociopath was ruled out as a suspect when credit card receipts proved his whereabouts as being in Washington State. I mean, I think it's really interesting when your alibi for not brutally killing a group of young women and preteen girls is that you were in another state raping and killing other females at the time. Cheers, Ted. So, then why the Zodiac? Let's take a look at why this actually does fit his MO. And I'm going to go at this from the perspective of Arthur Lee Allen being the Zodiac. Did Zodiac kill young women? Yes. Did he do so in rural places in California? Yes. Did he, meaning Allen, live near the Santa Rosa murders at the time? Yes, he lived alone in a Santa Rosa trailer that was in close proximity to these killings. Did Zodiac pick up hitchhikers, specifically young female hitchhikers? Yes, Zodiac abducted 22-year-old Kathleen Johns after suggesting he give her a ride to the gas station to get her car fixed. So, we don't have the use of a gun or a knife, but we can see Zodiac fits the MO of the killer, at least to a certain extent. So, without evidence, we'll offer analysis. Let's take a quick look back at Zodiac's killings. In December 1968, Arthur Lee Allen is in his 30s, living with his parents, and shamed by a molestation charge. What humans normally do during times of depression or great suffering is reflect upon not only how it came to be, but the fact that others are enjoying what they can't have. So, for most men in their 30s in 1968, an ideal situation, from the standpoint of societal acceptance, would be marriage, kids, career, and a nice home. Lee had none of these things at the time, but many people he knew did. In fact, since he remained in the area where he grew up, he got to watch his classmates from high school move on to having these things. And what types of people were these? They were the ones who were popular in high school, who were, quite frankly, accepted. And Lee, with his issues with children, boys and girls, could never quite have any of these things. So he would never be normal and would never be respected. Most importantly, it would be fair to say he never got to be young lovers like David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen enjoying a blissful evening along Lover's Lane. So he shot them. Or Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd picnicking at Lake Berryessa. So he stabbed them. The same goes for Michael McGough and Darlene Farren. And then we also know the Zodiac threatened to kill children. Something the Santa Rosa killer obviously did, with the girls being as young as 12. Now, take a look at the parallels between the two. Arthur Lee Allen got a job in the early 70s as a janitor at an elementary school, which was an obviously intentional move because he wanted to be closer to children. He had a huge amount of affection for them, even if it was corrupted to a great extent. At the same time, his warped love for them is the driving force for his abnormality in society, so he also simultaneously hates children because they are the object of his undoing from a respectful adult life that would have started to blossom years back with his own high school experiences at Lover's Lane and similar. But they never happened due to his problem. So what did the Zodiac do during this time period of Lee's employment at the school? He threatened children in letters to police and newspapers because he hated himself for what he was and wanted to punish the children as the cause of his misery. And so, accordingly, what did Arthur Lee Allen do as a full-time student at Sonoma State when he chose to surround himself with girls and young women, just as he did during that time at his job with kids? He killed them. You see, Lee returned to these institutions of education for their value in providing him a future, and did so with parallel intentions fully dedicated to simultaneously indulging his identity as the killer he was and the respectable adult with a normal life he wanted to be in the eyes of many, specifically his ailing father. So he went back to these places because that's where everything went wrong in the first place. This also parallels his failed military experience. Unable to keep himself from being thrown out of the Navy after a short time, and disgraced in the eyes of his proud father, who had a decorated career, Lee creates his own battlefield at home, where he not only hunts humans and evades capture, but ultimately has his house ripped apart by a 1991 search warrant that reveals a stockpile of guns and numerous diagrams for making bombs. Yet why did he have all of these things? He wasn't part of a militia, or a paranoid hater of the U.S. government waiting for the onset of anarchy? No. Once again, Lee created this facade of being a one-man army to cope with his own inadequacy, specifically the notion that he failed in the military. Everything in Arthur Lee Allen's adult life that caused him irreconcilable pain was dealt with in a manner of A, repetition, B, resolution conflicted by simultaneously unconscious and conscious desires, and C, retribution against the perceived cause. So, if we apply those consistencies to his atrocious acts, we could then see a clear motive for Lee to have committed the Santa Rosa murders. Retribution against his mother, who supposedly hated him, was the driving factor. Overall, he was just a misogynist as well. It was a well-known thing. Of course, he had just moved out of his mother's home in Vallejo at the time and was then alone in a trailer. So, if we've accounted for retribution in his desire, that's the first element in finding his motive. Now, what about resolution conflicted by simultaneously unconscious and conscious desires? We know Lee loved his mother as much as he hated her, and ultimately moved back into the home and lived with the woman until her death, taking care of her throughout. So when he moved out to go to school in Santa Rosa, it would be fair to say he ended up missing a person he also hates. Because Lee had this type of relationship with his mother, it was the basis for any romantic relationships he might have with other women. So it would be fair to say that Lee, just as any man, desperately wanted the attention of women, yet also hated them because, just as his mother had, they'd always disapproved of him from day one. College is a place where many adults meet and become partners for life. So Lee was simultaneously able to refresh this notion in his mind of potentially finding normalcy in a new life by returning to school, finding a career, and meeting a beautiful girl, but then kill her, which is something he did repeatedly to concurrently satisfy conflicting notions that he could get his life back on track while acting out his hate for his mother by killing. It was an entirely symbiotic relationship between his conflicting desires. One simply fed the other in a never-ending cycle of sickness, and each was refreshed by the other in a manner that allowed Lee to start all over again each time with just as much enthusiasm. And then let's take a look at how the Santa Rosa girls died. Strychnine poisoning, slow strangulation with a quarter rope, spinal compression, broken neck. These are all very slow deaths, and when they're over, in addition to his education at Sonoma State concluding, Lee goes back to Vallejo to live with his mother, where he watches her die slowly from old age until he's truly alone. But in the meantime, the dream finally ends for Lee, that dream of returning to a normal life. This time his repetition, molesting a young boy, lands him in another institution. But it isn't an elementary school or a college. It's a mental home. So it wouldn't be yet another new beginning for Lee. No, this time it would be the beginning of the end. He works odd jobs as his health fades until he dies of kidney failure due to diabetes in 1991. But maybe that dream never truly died with him. You see, Arthur Lee Allen wanted to get away from who he truly was, away from this life of constant struggle between good and evil. Accordingly, his last will and testament left one significant item to a friend, something that Lee had desperately held on to in the end, even as his hope of a better life, of finding peace, had been long gone. It wasn't a knife, or a gun, or even a bomb. That item was a sailboat. It had been grounded for years in somebody's backyard, the shores of the magnificent Pacific Ocean only miles away. And what a fitting end that is to a tragic existence, one from which Arthur Lee Allen could never quite escape. And by the way, truth be told, there were actually two sailboats, and I can only grin because I know for sure that Lee was planning to ride off into the sunset a second time if he screwed up the first go-around.
There still are people that believe that you killed your sister. What do you say about that?
Look at the evidence, or the lack thereof.
Part of their rationale, these people say you are the only one that your parents would go to the lengths that they went to cover up everything that happened. They're talking about fabricating this ransom note. They're talking about if she was strangled, then causing the head injury. All of this cover-up was all done to protect you because they didn't want to lose two children. That's their theory.
I don't know what to say to that because I know that's not what happened. There's been a few people that said that's not even physically possible for a 9-year-old to do that. Like, you won't find any evidence because that's not what happened. I know I didn't do it.
And I know what you're talking about. I mean, they're saying the force of the blow, the actual act of the strangulation for a child that weighed 60 pounds at the time.
Yeah.
Just physically, it doesn't work.
Do 9-year-olds sometimes kill siblings? Yes, but not with a garrote, with intricate knots tied around it, in the middle of the night, in their parents' home. He didn't do it.
You would never sit with this young boy and come away with the idea that he could have been involved in any aspect of what was a horrible and brutal murder of his sister.
Let's clear this up once and for all. Did you do anything to harm your sister, JonBenet?
No.
Did you murder your sister, JonBenet?
No.
So, At this point, we're going to do a 180 and turn the car back the other way to take a second look at some of the evidence in the JonBenet Ramsey case. More specifically, I've had some requests to dive a little deeper into three areas. One is analysis of Patsy's behavior during a 911 call. Two, a breakdown of the psychological implications evident in the ransom note. And finally, the infamous bowl of pineapple. But we won't be discussing this tasty treat in the context of JonBenet's time of death. Rather, we'll examine the possibility that the bowl was moved to disguise the actual location of the murder, and also why the Ramseys declined to wipe the fingerprints off the item when they'd allegedly done so with the flashlight. So, let's lead off with the 911 call. From my perspective, Patsy's deception begins in the fourth line where she answers operator Kim Archuleta's first question of, "What's going on?" with a response that does not describe the problem, but instead divulges the location of the problem. She replies, 755 15th Street. In this very short interaction, we've already established that there wasn't a kidnapping. The subject of this call, in the event of an actual kidnapping, would begin and end with JonBenet Ramsey, yet the call concludes without her name ever being mentioned. Notice as we move forward to examine the rest of the call, there's a consistent wall between Patsy's perception of the situation and the operator's. Patsy continues to assert her view of the call's subject matter in the next line, as the location of their home still exceeds the importance of the kidnapping. Quote, "We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please." Now, I understand this would be an incredibly stressful situation for a mother of a young child, but the fact remains that the girl is not in the house if she's been kidnapped, so why is there a huge rush to get there? Doesn't it seem far more reasonable and almost imperative to give the operator the child's description, name, age, and other identifying factors that might help the police find her? Patsy said it herself, quote, "We have a kidnapping." Her motive in this conversation is to establish the home as the scene of a kidnapping, not find her daughter. She did not say, "My daughter's been kidnapped." She specified, "We have a kidnapping." The difference is that the first statement presents a problem and allows the listener to posit a potential solution, while the second statement never establishes a modifier for the subject of kidnapping, because there isn't one. JonBenet hasn't been kidnapped, so the manner in which Patsy presents, "We have a kidnapping," is initially absent of any additional information. What's happening here is that Patsy is only going to provide info on an as-needed basis and will give very little beyond the operator's basic demands. Now, the operator immediately realizes she isn't getting the appropriate info from Patsy, so she very clearly says, "Explain to me what is going on, okay?" And right here is where she asserts herself, essentially telling Patsy her answer doesn't cut it. And so what happens when Patsy tries to answer in the face of this? She starts with a sentence that seems like it's only going to repeat what she's already said. But then she cuts herself short. Here it is. She repeats, quote, "We have a..." But she stops short. She wants to simply repeat, "We have a kidnapping." But even she realizes, just as we do now, that this answer is not only odd in terms of word choice, but telling of the speaker's desires. So she balks, pauses a second, then makes the most conservative move possible by continuing with, quote, "There was a note left." And before I even analyze that statement, let's already take inventory on the passive, ambiguous language being utilized here in regards to Patsy's dishonesty and attempt to distance herself from the crime. Quote, "We have a kidnapping." Quote, "There was a note left." And right here, since she's already been challenged for the first time with an explicit demand for an explanation as to what's happening in her home, she wilts and immediately backs off her prior statement with, quote, "Our daughter is gone." She can't even bring herself to try to sell the kidnapping at this point, so she softens the statement accordingly in an effort to not elaborate any further on a recorded call. And I have to say I've always been impressed with Kim Archuleta's handling of this nonsense. I mean, at this point, the operator remains staunchly dedicated to getting an explanation, but realizes she can't repeat herself or she'll get the same answer. So she rephrases the request as, quote, "A note was left and your daughter is gone?" This line is less demanding, more open-ended, and certainly more open-minded. It sounds like somebody who's ready to shut up, listen, and care. But how does Patsy respond? She merely says yes, and nothing more. I don't know about you, but at this point I'd be blabbering on and on about things that could potentially help find my daughter. But Patsy is still tight-lipped, So Kim, realizing this is going to be like pulling teeth, tosses her a bit of bait with, quote, "How old is your daughter?" This was a great move because it's a very simple, basic inquiry that absolutely must be answered in order to lend legitimacy to the call. It's a toll booth, and Patsy can't get through unless she pays the price of admission. Also, Patsy realizes with this questioning that she has to concede just a little more to sound legit. So she offers JonBenet's age and follows with her hair color. But instead of offering her name at that point, she uses the opportunity to deny any further details by repeating JonBenet's age. This is the only info demanded from her, and she quickly reverts to it once she realizes she's crossed the threshold into discussing further details. Archuleta wisely realizes she can only proceed with questioning in this manner, that any blanket inquiry is not going to be met with satisfactory answers, so she continues with, "How long ago was this?" Okay, so let's stop here for a moment. We have a woman claiming her daughter's been kidnapped, but she's so unwilling to undergo the process of legitimizing this event that the 911 operator is forced to revert from questions that would assist in finding a missing child to questions posed with an interest in learning whether or not there was actually a kidnapping in the first place. So Patsy says, "I don't know. I just found a note and my daughter's missing." Again, no mention of JonBenet's name or what she was wearing, which is hilarious when we later learn some of her clothes had been mysteriously disposed of during the crime and not recovered. At that point, Archuleta's next question is, "Does it say who took her?" And again, I need to pause on that line because I think there are some really interesting politics going on here. With the operator clearly sniffing this out from the beginning as problematic and leaning on Patsy hard in the aftermath with focused, singular questions that give her no room for interpretation and rephrasing upon receipt. This is brilliant, because while it seems to only be relevant to knowing if there's already a guilty party the police can pursue at this point, Patsy is actually getting set up to provide more info than she would like. And she knows it, so she balks again and keeps Archuleta at bay by feigning to not hear the question and asking, "What?" Essentially forcing Kim to repeat herself in favor of getting more time to provide an appropriate answer. She's caught off guard by this, because to this point, it's apparent she didn't consider she was going to be asked that question. So she hesitates, regroups during Kim's repeating of the question, and decides the best answer is denial. So she starts with, "No," but then instantly realizes that she identified the so-called kidnappers to a point in the ransom note, but not definitively. So she follows up with, "I don't know." So, which is it? No, or I don't know? Patsy realizes this still needs to be clarified, and she's not willing to provide any more info. So once again, she reverts to the company line of, quote, "It's there. There is a ransom note here." As though she's still trying to assert that her deficient info will suffice for the purposes of the call. But Archuleta is not giving up. She leads Patsy into the next question in the same open-ended way by asking, "It's a ransom note?" At this point, Patsy knows she must directly address the ransom note, so instead of providing the info about the small foreign faction that claims to have taken her daughter, or even the mention of two men watching over her, Patsy says the note reads, "SBTC Victory," because that is absolutely the least helpful identifying factor at this point. It's too mysterious to be debunked offhand, and she already knows the letters carry no significance, at least as it pertains to this crime. It then Patsy gets desperate. She ends that sentence with a pause before adding an emphatic and longing, "Please." What's happening here is that Patsy is trying to indirectly accuse the operator of not trying to help her, but because she won't fulfill her request to get police to the home without further questioning. It's a guilt trip, plain and simple, and a good move on Patsy's part because it forces Archuleta to doubt herself just long enough to back off a bit. And quite frankly, this is a dead end for the operator, as she's not privileged to seeing the note, so she gets back to pertinent identification factors that will help. She asks, "What's your name? Are you?" and is cut off by Patsy, who responds, "Patsy Ramsey. I am the mother." Now, for me, this instance of "the" preceding the subject is indicative of an existing event taking place and not familial delineation. "The" does not indicate a relationship to another person. It indicates a role in an event taking place. For instance, imagine yourself at the Ramsey's January 1997 press conference on CNN, and the person sitting next to you isn't familiar with Patsy, so he asks, Is that the mother? Within that context, it's a perfectly normal inquiry, as we've established a story that has been lived. However, it's apparent the story has already been alive in Patsy's mind for quite some time, not just minutes since she suddenly found a note, as she truly has already projected this story numerous times with herself as, quote, the mother, in the same way you might meet someone new and exciting and project your romance well into the future, culminating in an event such as marriage, kids, etc. The words, quote, I am her mother, would have established a clearly defined relationship to a living, breathing JonBenet, as should be the case in a kidnapping where there's not yet reason to believe the child is dead. You know, like when a ransom note is involved? Inserting the word the instead of the more personal her indicates a sense of detachment from the subject on the part of the speaker. In this case, as we know, that detachment was the fact that JonBenet was already dead, and her mother's answers reveal that she knew. So, Patsy, having already established some success at slowing Kim's roll with a desperate cry of please, belts out another one with an escalated, oh my god, please, immediately after uttering the sentence as well, knowing that last time Archuleta flinched. And what happens? The operator flinches again. Instead of pressing Patsy for more info, she says, I'm sending an officer over, okay? And at this point, Archuleta has wilted, to the point she's not even sure if she believes what she's just said. So she ends the sentence with a question, okay? Putting Patsy right in the driver's seat and asking if she's finally met the upset woman's demands. And now Patsy realizes this, and she hits the gas pedal, pumping out another desperate please, even after Archuleta has explicitly conceded control. But this is where the operator redeems herself. She knows she just got her ass kicked and quickly turns the tables at the realization. You see, she already said she's sending an officer. Patsy has what she wants now, so it's time for Kim to press her on further details to see if this is actually legitimate. So she returns to her questioning with, quote, do you know how long she's been gone? So after Patsy, having already been told an officer is being sent, she begs once again. No, I don't. Please, we just got up and she's not here. Oh my God, please. Notice that each of these statements ends in please as a manner of requesting something that's already happened, the police being sent. At this point, notice that please is being utilized after every answer as a tool for bringing the call to a close. Patsy is crafting a ludicrous but definitive correlation between the cops arriving at her home and the issue being resolved. In this context, we understand that the issue is at the home and is not a kidnapping taking place outside its walls. She never begs for anybody to find her daughter. She only begs for the police to come to her home. At this point, her false hyperventilation is reaching a crescendo. If Kim won't stop asking questions, she's going to feign a condition that's conducive to not answering them. So the operator backs off and merely says, okay. Now, this isn't an intentionally great move on her part, but it's very effective nonetheless, at least for our purposes today, because it provides so little info that it forces Patsy to interpret the situation, specifically where she stands in terms of believability. It isn't a question, a statement, or anything more significant than temporary placation, so it stops her in her tracks. And so, we already know what her response is going to be, don't we? She says, please send somebody. But we've been down this road over and over. So Kim says, I am, honey. Now that Patsy has her confirmation, she knows she can't ask again. So what does she do? She says one word. Please. Archuleta responds, take a deep breath for me, okay? Now, a normal human would interpret this as a request to try to calm down so the two of them can make progress on the issue at hand, and then comply. But Patsy knows the questions aren't going to get any easier, and her answers are all recorded. So what does she do? She says, hurry, 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 then hangs up the phone, precluding any opportunity to provide info about her daughter. And with that, we end the exchange without the missing girl's name being divulged. Kim calls out Patsy's name repeatedly thereafter, but she's already hung up. Of course, we know about the voices that appear at the end of this phone call, which is, you know, something I covered in a previous episode. But here I want to point out that 7 minutes pass before Officer French arrives at the home, And if he read the ransom note before searching the house, it wouldn't have been much more than 15 minutes after the 911 call by the time he found himself pausing outside the closed wine cellar door. And of course, this is exactly as the Ramseys had intended. Patsy was begging for him to get there. He was supposed to find the body, and Patsy wanted that incredibly anxious part of the process over as soon as possible. I mean, just ask yourself how much pertinent information about your child you could provide in 7 minutes. In all honesty, you could tell the kid's life story. You could establish detailed timelines and divulge relationships with friends, family, neighbors, etc. The police would know exactly who to look for and know these things 7 minutes sooner than they would otherwise. But if the kid's dead body is in your basement, and you know it, then those things have no value, so you would act accordingly. Of course, many people say, well, she's in a panic. You can't hold her accountable for her actions during that call. To such people, I would say that, you know, often children perform 10 times better than that on 911 calls, so really don't know where to go there. All right, moving on. So the ransom note. Regarding this masterpiece, the first thing I very shamefully need to admit is that I laughed the first time I read it. However, in the absence of its comedic value, it's essentially toilet paper. I mean, it wastes no time in tanking its legitimacy in the first line that emphatically tells Mr. Ramsey to, quote, listen carefully. Not only is it unnecessary to demand the attention of someone whose daughter you've just kidnapped, but in fact, there isn't anybody in the room shouting. Nor is there anybody in the room to hear the words, because paper can't talk. But the next line is quite telling about the motive of this letter. It has nothing to do with a kidnapping. So let's analyze the first several lines here. Quote, we are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. A group of individuals? Notice the lack of solidarity here. That's not a team. The writer doesn't know what they are because they don't exist. And then the word small as it pertains to this foreign faction? Why? I mean, here you are perpetrating a kidnapping, and the first thing you do in the ransom note is diminish the intimidation factor by claiming you're small. And foreign? Don't even get me started here. That's not how you describe yourself. It's how somebody else describes you. But most important in this line is the way it tries to establish that the root cause of this issue is in a faraway land that is not the Ramsey house, and perpetrated by a group that is foreign, and obviously completely disconnected with the Ramsey family in their house. And it's a dim connection at first, but watch how this thing lights up like a Christmas tree in the next few lines. Quote, we respect your business, but not the country it serves. So, right here, we once again take the focus away from the Ramsey home and put it on John's business, which the kidnapper strangely endorses. At this point, Patsy, whom I firmly believe wrote this note, tries to steer blame away from the family members, the Ramsey home, and John's business by suggesting the United States, as a whole, is to blame. But notice there's no animosity or finger-pointing toward the Ramseys in this note, which, of course, makes them what? Victims. This is what Patsy is establishing. The next line is, quote, at this time we have your daughter in our possession. This line is completely overwrought. But the bottom line is that now the previous line has taken the blame out of the home, off the Ramseys, and away from John's business. Patsy has to try to establish that the body isn't around. In fact, she realizes at this point she can't even approach it that way because the cops obviously don't know it's only a dead body yet. So she oversells the next line. Quote, she is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. Safe and unharmed? This redundancy seems intentional to sell its legitimacy. I can't see another reason to stress the point so much. It's not like parents decline to have their missing kids returned if they have rope burn on their wrists or ankles, or even worse injuries. I mean, we know stories of parents holding out hope that their missing children will return even decades later. So, here we are at the end of the first paragraph. Things to note. There's been no mention of JonBenet's name, just as in the 911 call. There's been no demand for money. Finally, the note establishes the perpetrators are from outside the house and even the country. They have no beef with the Ramseys, and the fact JonBenet is alive and well somewhere outside the house in someone else's possession. While most ransom notes have concluded by this point, we march on. Here we finally get to the money with, you will withdraw $118,000 from your account. The number, which matches John Ramsey's Christmas bonus, is a small number because, well, you get it. Is your daughter worth more than your Christmas bonus? And what account are they talking about? It almost sounds as though they're familiar with it and the way that John banks. But really, since when do kidnappers care about where you get the money? So, after demanding specific denominations for the ransom, the kidnapper delivers the first in a series of bizarrely maternal thoughts that betray the intentions of someone who would brutally kidnap, rape, and murder a six-year-old girl. The first is, quote, "Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank with you." This sounds like your grandmother reminding you to bring an umbrella in case it rains. Like John Ramsey is going to throw up his hands and quit trying to recover his daughter if the bag he brings for the money isn't big enough. The next line acts as somewhat of a companion to its predecessor with, quote, "When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag." Why? And here we have an abrupt shift in perspective as the writer shifts to a first-person narrative. "We" suddenly becomes "I" with the following lines. "I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. Now, not only have we returned to a maternalistic tone, as though a kidnapper cares about how much sleep you've had, but the time frame is ridiculous. Even if the kidnapper was somehow able to elude being detected by getting JonBenet out of the house by 11:59 p.m. on Christmas night, and intentionally without being heard or seen, leaving the ransom note at the bottom of the back stairs means it's intended to be found in the morning when the family wakes up. So within this context, exactly when is tomorrow? Because the Ramseys supposedly don't even know if she was taken before or after midnight at this point. The truth is that the writer doesn't specify because it doesn't matter. The girl is dead, and the phone is never going to ring. But here's where the writer catches the mistake of shifting perspectives from we to I. And it's easy to see why it happened. It was precipitated by the notion that the kidnappers would be calling, but since only one of them would actually be holding the phone, the writer naturally switches to first person. And she should have left it that way, but here's where she backpedals in the aftermath and flounders in her mistake. She overdoes the third person by forcing its usage multiple times into a circuitous sentence to compensate. Quote, "If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence an earlier pickup of the money." Earlier delivery of your daughter and hence an earlier pickup of the money. My first impression is that sentence has panic written all over it. Now, there are multiple callers, and they're going to call even earlier to get their money if the Ramseys have it, thereby returning the kid earlier, too. Great. Have they thought about when the bank opens the day after Christmas in 1996? If they've already directed John to withdraw the money from, quote, his account, shouldn't they be aware of this detail? No, because there won't be anybody to pick it up anyway. But for me, the best part of that sentence is the word that's crossed out. Delivery was written instead of pickup, preceding the words of your daughter. And remember that there were multiple practice notes before this one, so even after several drafts, the writer was still stumped by the fact the body was actually in her possession as a mother while trying to write from the perspective of a kidnapper. The cherry on top, of course, is that a Christmas message from the Ramseys on their website in 1997 also contained the words "and hence." And those words? They were written by Patsy. So, at this point, we're not even halfway through the note, but the one thing that strikes me as being incredibly odd is the notion that the writer is foreign. There is nothing about this letter that indicates it was written by anybody other than an American who is a native speaker of the English language. In fact, the writer goes on to prove to us later in the note with the line that tells John, "Use that good Southern common sense of yours." If the writer is part of a foreign faction, the geographical relevance of Southern would be quite different from his perspective. Then, in the final 60% of the note, what we get is a barrage of threats that are thinly veiled to the extent we can see they have no purpose other than to hammer home the false narrative that JonBenet is still alive. And the remaining text places her whereabouts outside the home with people who are definitively not the Ramseys, all of which we know is false. In fact, everything involving the kidnappers slash murderers in this case is a lie. More accurately, it's fiction, even fantastical at times. We have one broken window in a basement to suggest there was a kidnapper, And who broke that window? John Ramsey. How can we even begin to have a discussion about DNA found on JonBenet being relevant when she was partially stripped of her clothing, wiped down with a strange substance, and subsequently covered by no fewer than two blankets and a sweatshirt? But what does this have to do with Dirty Harry, Keanu Reeves, or even the Zodiac Killer? Let's take a look at the madness. The next line is this: any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. This is straight Hollywood, specifically the 1986 Danny DeVito comedy Ruthless People. So while the Hollywood theme has been light to this point, with only the opening line of "listen carefully" being lifted directly from the same silly ransom note, this is where it starts to get ridiculous. In fact, most of the rest of the note is just an alternate version of what appears in the film, which was especially easy to correlate for the writer of the Ramsey note because both letters are fake and there are no specifics regarding JonBenet Ramsey in either of them, not even her name. So here I'll read the rest of the text and comment thereafter. Quote, "You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you to not provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think the killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory, signed SBTC. So, as we're coming down the home stretch on this letter, the kidnapper wants us to know that the Ramseys will be denied their daughter's remains if she's executed due to not following instructions. Okay, so aside from the fact that this also comes from Ruthless People, what I'm supposed to believe is that most parents would expect to receive their daughter's remains for proper burial in the event that she's killed by dangerous criminals. But in this exact instance, that won't be the case if they screw up. Okay, I got it. Then we learned, as though a small foreign faction didn't already sound small enough, that there are only two men watching over JonBenet. First of all, watching over is a term most commonly associated with God's relationship to the lives of human beings, especially dead ones. In this context, Patsy, a known believer, is subconsciously telling us that JonBenet is already dead as she writes this. Moreover, the writer wants us to know these gentlemen don't particularly like John, even though the letter starts by stating their problem isn't with him, but with the country his business serves. Then, after threatening to behead JonBenet if anyone goes to the police, the writer spares no shame whatsoever and drops a line right out of the legendary Clint Eastwood flick Dirty Harry with, quote, if we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. This film chronicles a San Francisco killer directly inspired by the Zodiac. So this is followed by a few more movie lines from the same films, more or less. And then the kidnapper boasts, quote, you and the authorities are under constant scrutiny. Really? You just accidentally went from third to first person composition in your writing and then diminished your faction to only two men protecting the prized little girl. At best, this is actually one or two total people involved, but subsequently you have the audacity to suggest that you possess the manpower to not only levy surveillance on the Ramseys, but all of law enforcement, including the FBI. There is something absolutely hilarious about trying to sell the charade, especially after calling yourself small. And the writer knows it, but can't stop because this level of indulgence in the fantasy could never possibly sell a story that must be sold to work. So what do you do when your acting job has gotten so bad that not even most lines from classic Hollywood films are ridiculous enough to convince the subject of your demands? You turn to Keanu Reeves. I mean, are you fucking kidding me? They go straight out of the 1994 hit film Speed, where Dennis Hopper utters to Keanu's character, don't try to grow a brain, John. Of course, What's even more notable about this line is that now the writer is referring to Mr. Ramsey as John. So here it should be noted that as the writer gets more desperate, the letter becomes more personal and demanding regarding John Ramsey, whereas it distanced him from the situation in the beginning by suggesting the United States was the problem. Now the sole focus is on him. So at this point, the story is on paper, but the truth is still in the writer's mind. JonBenet is dead, and here's where the writer admits it with this line. "You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult." This line is intended to incite fear and leave the door open to JonBenet ending up dead. But what it actually says is that this particular kidnapping isn't important to them, that they could just move on to somebody else with money and get the same result. So, does this sound like a well-orchestrated, elaborate scheme perpetrated by a group of foreigners who would greatly benefit by all of them sharing a sum as small as $118,000? No. But before this thing comes to a close, the desperation has to reach a pinnacle, at which point the writer's identity is most transparent by nature of the lies told within. Here's how it reads. Quote, "Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John." These last lines are very personal, even more so than the previous few. Here the killers instruct John Ramsey not to underestimate them. Hold on a second here, though. Did we not just have almost 3 pages dedicated to that exact notion? Why the repetition? Simple. Because the person writing isn't buying this BS as she moves it across the page, and she knows the reader isn't going to either. So here's what I'll ask you to do. Let me read the last 3 lines again, out of context, and listen to how the meaning of these words reveals the truth. Now, picture John and Patsy standing in their kitchen on a normal morning having coffee during a conversation. There's no kidnapping taking place, but John Ramsey suddenly puts down his mug and reveals to his wife that his company is tanking, and he doesn't think he can stop it from happening, that he believes they could lose the house and all their other possessions if he doesn't pull off a miracle in the boardroom Monday morning. Patsy obviously sympathizes because she's now scared about this too. Her wonderful lifestyle is at stake. Her children's too. She puts down her mug, gently touches John's arm, and calmly says, in the following words lifted directly from the ransom note, that she believes in him. Quote, "Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John." In this light, we can see the true meaning of these words in the note. And what follows in the text, as she gets John pumped up with that emphatic last line, is the lofty goal the Ramseys desperately want to achieve from this terrible situation of them versus the police that is about to arise. Victory. And then the letter is mysteriously signed below that with the letters SBTC, which aren't that mysterious when you realize that Subic Bay Training Center was written at the bottom of a large framed picture of an aircraft carrier that hung on the wall in John Ramsey's office in front of his desk. At least, that is, until the cops allegedly found it in a closet in the basement the day after the crime. Another thing that's worth mentioning here is that, in March 1998, Boulder District Attorney Alex Hunter, upon receiving a nearly 100-page report from Vassar linguistics expert Donald Foster concluding that Patsy had written the ransom note, decided to not present this information to the grand jury because he thought it would be inadmissible in court, specifically due to the fact the search warrant for the Ramsey's computer, from which some samples were taken, only allowed files to be removed that were directly related to child pornography, which was at the time suspected of potentially being on the hard drive. Plus, when police approached Patsy's mother for a sample of her daughter's handwriting after the crime, they found certain characteristics to be corrected, so to speak, by being crossed out and covered with a felt-tip pen. Of particular note were corrections to the letter A, which appears in the ransom note over 100 times, with no rhyme or reason for using both manuscript and cursive styles. So, with that, let's move on to the bowl of pineapple. The traditional thinking surrounding this crucial piece of evidence in the case is to approach it within the context of JonBenet's time of death. Of course, it has immense value from that perspective, but it troubles me that most of us accept, without question, that the bowl of pineapple was always on the table where the cops found it when they arrived. Due to this, the murder scene is now commonly considered to be the kitchen area, especially with the flashlight sitting nearby and its fingerprints wiped off. And while I admit I'm also inclined to believe it happened in this spot, perhaps this subject warrants a bit more consideration. So let's start with the basis for the cover-up, the thematic foundation that grounds all of the parents' decisions as they take each step in the process. It could be defined in one word. Confusion. Was this a sex crime? Was it a kidnapping? Was it both? Or was it just made to look like one of these things? Or all of them? Oh, look at the ransom note. Do the Ramseys know the criminals? Maybe it's one of their friends. Maybe it's their housekeeper. Maybe it's Santa Claus. Maybe it's a total crock of shit. And these considerations just go on and on, because the whole point of the Ramseys' diversion was to throw as many balls in the air as possible, with no regard for how to juggle them when they finally descended to reality upon examination. This is why they cooperated with police for 3 days, and then withheld contact for months at the point the police realized they were a circus act. This happened not due to hasty efforts on the part of the cops, but specifically because of the short shelf life of the lies the Ramseys told. Notice that even after several months pass, the Ramseys are still unwilling to speak to Boulder police. Think about this for a second. The prime suspects in a murder case won't talk to police because the police think they're guilty. Is this not the epitome of privilege? This is a routine situation, and the Ramseys painted a false portrait that they were being railroaded throughout. Meanwhile, what the cops were actually trying to do was catch JonBenet's killer. That is exactly what the Ramseys wanted to stop them from doing. And why? Because Burke Ramsey killed her. And the bowl of pineapple might have been moved to avoid revealing the train room in the basement as the murder scene. So it occurred to me the other day that I've always accepted the proposal that the two bruised punctures on JonBenet's lower back, once ignorantly believed to be taser marks to support the intruder theory, were caused by Burke poking over this section of his train set tracks, which were proven to match the wound perfectly. The suggestion is that Burke did so in disbelief that the little girl was dead after he'd hit her over the head with a heavy object in a fit of rage. It's a perfectly reasonable reaction for a 9-year-old who isn't quite past the denial of the fact he's just killed his sister and will need to tell his parents. But wait a minute. The train tracks were in the basement, and crime scene photos even showed a couple of loose tracks lying on the floor disconnected. So does it sound reasonable for Burke to go down into the basement and get a section of track when, assuming he's at the table with the pineapple and tea, he's already right next to a kitchen where any number of objects would have sufficed? No. So is it then more likely the murder was committed in the basement? Yes. Okay, so let's go down there. We're in the hobby room, as they called it. It's more commonly known as the train room in the context of the crime. Right next to it is a fairly packed storage area that's somewhat messy. And Burke, who probably has no intention of going to bed as he enters with a glass of tea, also carries a bowl of pineapples and milk in the other hand. JonBenet then rumbles down the stairs behind him and into the room to see what's going on. Now, I want to pause here for a moment to try to get some better insight into the relationship between JonBenet and Burke. To adult eyes, these 6 and 9-year-olds seem similar in the sense that they're both young kids. But let's consider that the 3-year age gap, not to mention the gender gap, renders them very different people. How close could we expect them to be, considering that we know Burke wiped feces throughout JonBenet's bedroom and on her Christmas present, and another time left a mound of it in her bed? Well, according to John Ramsey, sometimes JonBenet would sleep in Burke's room. And for me, what's really telling about this admission Mr. Ramsey gave in an interview with detectives is that he and Patsy say on the morning of the alleged kidnapping, when they found the ransom note, they went to Burke's room to see if she was in there, and without waking Burke while searching his room frantically for his missing sister. Ahem. And we know from their police interrogations they first expected her to be in her own bed because that's where they claimed to have left her the night before when they got home. So what they really admitted to is the fact that sometimes JonBenet would sleep in Burke's room without them knowing about it, even after being put to bed in her own room. And there was such a strong possibility it happened again that it was the first thing they considered after checking her empty bed, even before wondering about Burke's safety. So, on these occasions that JonBenet slept in Burke's room, what is it that drew her to be so close to a sibling with such disdain for her? Was she compelled to spend time with Burke, or was she lured into his room? I have no doubt there are plenty of male and female siblings with similar age gaps who sleep together in a perfectly normal circumstances. And there are probably others who would be horrified by the thought. The bottom line, however, is that the Ramseys were aware and seemed to think nothing of it. But think back to Burke spreading the feces all over JonBenet's room. Even if we don't have the necessary info to understand the full motivation for this action, we can say that it probably precluded JonBenet from sleeping in her room the night it happened, due to obvious considerations. And where is the next most likely place she'd have gone to bed after that? According to John and Patsy Ramsey, it was Burke's room. So, was it intentional, in the sense that Burke wasn't going to let her say no? Might Burke have been angry that week about JonBenet starting to thwart his advances? Was there some type of a situation already brewing between them that precipitated the murder? And while I'm certainly no expert in the field of autistic disorders, it seems to me that if Burke had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, it's reasonable to say he struggled with certain social interactions, even to the extent his understanding of how to properly process them, from a cognitive standpoint, was limited. It would then also be reasonable to suggest these abnormalities, for lack of a better term, might extend to more private and intimate social interactions, such as sexual activity with another person. With Burke being only 9 years old, which is immature in almost any context, and his 6-year-old sister constantly dressed up as a beauty queen, could his desires have been accelerated and perhaps warped as a result of such? I don't know. What we do know is that JonBenet was likely the victim of prior sexual abuse from her autopsy results. So, is it unreasonable to suggest that maybe Burke essentially lured JonBenet downstairs with the pineapple, intentionally or not, in much the same way the Ramseys have accused a phantom intruder? You see, common wisdom has been that JonBenet was struck for taking the pineapple, which again is a perfectly reasonable possibility. But I'm proposing in this situation that the fact the little girl only had one piece in her stomach wasn't because of a disagreement over the snack ending in murder, but the fact that the snacking was precluded by Burke's true motivation for bringing the girl downstairs. I mean, might he have forgone the train in favor of the aforementioned abuse? Remember, the sexual abuse was never described as intercourse. But what if it was? I can recall being in nursery school, and one of the little boys would masturbate on a regular basis during nap time. Years later, I dated a girl who worked as a teacher in one of those schools, and she said it was more common than I'd think, that she had a couple of boys in her class over several years who did that. So, while I didn't do it, and maybe you didn't either, sexual activity among small children is actually somewhat prevalent. With that, we could say it's plausible Burke could easily have killed his sister with a strike to the head using a flashlight to stop her from running upstairs and telling one of her parents when he wouldn't stop his advances. And here's where the pineapple might be telling us more than we think. The spoon in the bowl is oversized, almost too big for a child's mouth. This is something I commonly did as a kid when I made my own cereal because, as a growing boy, I always wanted to shovel the sugary goodness into my mouth. When I first saw the photo of this at the crime scene, I was immediately struck by the truth. So, I believe Burke prepared the pineapple snack, at least in terms of the bowl and spoon, and Patsy likely cut the fruit for him, but who knows the truth on that. So then, how does Patsy end up with fingerprints on the bowl? I believe she brought the pineapple and tea back upstairs from the basement upon learning of what happened, and left them on the table. And I think this is a good place to stop and consider the manner in which the cover-up unfolded. I don't really believe the crime started as a full-blown effort to deceive the police into thinking the killer was an intruder. Humans generally make the most conservative move they feel will complete the job at hand. So we have to consider that the Ramseys first wanted to pose the scene as an accident, or at least a situation where JonBenet and Burke got into a little roughhousing that resulted in an accident. But the severity of the blow to the head seems to preclude this possibility, at least to some extent, and honestly makes me wonder if Patsy witnessed the murder and was inclined to jump right into a cover-up for lack of any other solution. Either way, I believe it was her decision, and not John's, that initiated the process. So, let's consider the circumstances this way. Patsy brings the bowl upstairs after finding JonBenet dead, far away from the plethora of children's toys in the hobby room that would potentially be viewed as a breeding ground for two kids having a disagreement over something, whether it's a toy, harsh words, that one of them said about the other, or even a snack they were sharing. She then places the bowl in a very natural spot, on the table, where there will never be any suspicion it was ever anywhere else besides the dishwasher and the cabinets before this time. In that light, it goes from a potential centerpiece of evidence for creating a motive for murder to being nothing more than a bowl of partially eaten pineapple at the table. With this one swift action, Patsy is able to negate the location of the murder scene and squash the potential motive for the crime. That's huge, and you better believe she realizes this. But then it hits her. Oh no. Burke, did your sister swallow any of the pineapple? And he says she did, that it was the piece that started the fight between them. Because he isn't going to refer to the sexual abuse, of course. Patsy panics and thinks of ways to dispose of the bowl and the fruit, but ends up believing everything will be fine because there's still no reason for the cops to believe it couldn't have been an accident. So she leaves it right there on the table, as is, a perfectly normal remnant of a snack that was so regularly eaten at the house that they casually forgot whether or not they'd made any that day. Is that scenario perfect? No. But it beats having the cops find bits of pineapple in your garbage disposal or a spot of the juice on the rim of your toilet. And here's the reason, again, why the Ramseys did this. It fits within their theme. Confusion. 20 years later, we still want to know why they wiped down the flashlight, but not the pineapple bowl and tea glass. While the logic that supports the Ramseys' desire to do this is elusive, I believe this is the closest answer we can provide. The flashlight was part of the murder, but the pineapple bowl was part of the cover-up. This is consistent with everything else in the crime. For instance, JonBenet's body was also wiped down because it was connected to the actual murder, while evidence of practice versions of the ransom note, obviously tied to a cover-up, was left right out in the open to find. Taking it a step further, just consider that JonBenet's dead body was hidden in the farthest corner of the basement, where it was least likely to have been found. In fact, it took 7 hours, and the person who found it, John Ramsey, is suspected of having known it was there all along. The police just overlooked it. Long story short, somebody hid this thing as well as you possibly could have within the house, and that was intentional. But Patsy's paint tray, which was used extensively in the cover-up to construct the garrote and ligature with broken paintbrush handles, and had only been taken to the basement by the housekeeper days earlier, that was left right out in the open for police to find, full of fibers from the jacket she wore that night. And the reason we continue to find this consistency throughout the crime scene in a comparison of evidence tied directly to the murder, as opposed to evidence tied to the cover-up, is that the one thing the Ramseys must protect is the fact that this is a murder. Because the murder is tied to their son. On the other hand, the cover-up is tied to them. What each parent is saying by behaving this way during the cover-up is that each of them is willing to take one for the team, so to speak. But God is their witness. Hell or high water, their son is not going down for this crime. And in that regard, we can then see the truth behind their motivations. They wanted to protect their son. Nothing more. They simply did not have enough time or resources to cover their own asses to the fullest extent. This was about Burke. And I think that really sheds a human light on their story. That undying spirit of being a child's parent. Of continuing to embrace the person, despite his evil actions. It says a lot about forgiveness and loyalty. But above all else, it reminds us, in our short time on this earth, everything we need to understand about love. Because the cover-up in the JonBenet Ramsey murder, in all of its vast complexity, is really just a microcosm of life. It's about finding a way to reconcile the difference between the love we've had, the love we've lost, and the courage to keep searching for peace in the face of incredible adversity. This is what the Ramseys did, and it's what you and I continue to do, even right now.